Right now, an artist named Eddie Dalton is holding 11 spots on the iTunes top singles chart, like all at the exact same time.
11 spots, which is just, yeah, unprecedented.
It's completely wild. Millions of fans are streaming his music, they're saving his tracks, adding him to their daily playlists. But here is the crazy part. Eddie Dalton does not exist.
Right, not a real person at all.
No.
Yeah.
He is not a human being. He is a completely autonomous AI-generated persona that is actively like dominating global pop culture as we speak.
It's a surreal moment for the music industry, I mean, truly.
Yeah.
But it perfectly encapsulates this strange reality we're living in today. The boundary between what is human and what is synthetic, it isn't just blurring anymore. In some arenas, it has completely vanished.
It really has. And you know, that is exactly why you are here with us for another deep dive. Our mission today is to take a stack of dispatches from the April 7, 2026 edition of Tech and AI Daily and just distill the absolute noise of the news cycle into high signal insights.
Because there is a lot of noise right now.
So much noise. We want to give you an edge, catching you up on this rapidly shifting tech landscape without, you know, burying you in information overload. And looking at today's sources, going from the billionaires controlling the silicon, all the way down to the actual code running silently on your laptop, there's this fascinating tension right now.
Yeah, a massive tension.
Right, between the massive geopolitical macro level of AI and the messy, unpredictable micro level of how we actually use it every single day.
And I think that tension is basically the defining story of the year. On one side, we have these towering infrastructural monopolies and global security threats. And on the other side, we have individual developers just trying to get a coding assistant to work without it suddenly forgetting how to write a basic function.
Okay, let's unpack this, starting at the macro level, because if we're going to understand why the ground level is so messy, we really have to look at the people pulling the strings.
Yeah, the Titans at the top.
Exactly. So the New Yorker just dropped this sprawling profile on OpenAI's Sam Altman, and reading through it, I kept thinking of The Wizard of Oz.
Oh, that's a good comparison.
Right, you have this towering figure projecting immense world-altering power. And the magazine is basically trying to pull back the curtain to see if the man operating the machine can actually be trusted. But it felt heavily focused on his personal psychology rather than, you know, the tech itself.
It is heavily focused on his psychology, definitely. But we really shouldn't dismiss that as just industry gossip.
You think it has real weight?
Oh, absolutely. The public perception of a leader's trustworthiness is an active structural component of how this technology will be governed. I mean, regulators in Washington and Brussels aren't just reading white papers on neural networks.
Right, they're reading The New Yorker.
Exactly. They're reading these cultural profiles. If the collective consensus becomes that the wizard is untrustworthy, regulators won't just ask for more transparency. They will try to dismantle the machine entirely.
Oh. But you know, while regulators are agonizing over trust, it seems like the labs themselves are just exclusively focused on raw physical power.
Hardware is everything right now.
Yeah, because the dispatch notes that Anthropic just locked in a massive next-generation compute partnership with Google and Broadcom. They are securing infrastructure for future Claude models. But here's what I don't quite get.
Okay, what's that?
Anthropic is a software company,
Yeah.
right? They're building an AI mind. If they are relying so completely on Broadcom for the physical chips, doesn't whoever controls the hardware roadmap essentially dictate the timeline of the AI itself?
Yes, 100%.
Yeah.
Though the reality of that dependency is even more severe than just timelines. We often talk about AI as if it's this ethereal thing living up in the cloud.
Right, just floating around digitally.
Right. But a frontier model is a physical terrestrial behemoth. To train a next generation transformer model, you aren't just running a clever algorithm on a fast computer.
No.
No, you are executing massively parallel processing that requires hundreds of thousands of GPUs firing in perfect, synchronized harmony inside a data center the size of a football field.
So the algorithm itself is essentially useless without the exact physical silicon to run it.
Exactly. The hardware is the algorithmic ceiling. By partnering with Google and Broadcom, Anthropic is trying to buy immunity from supply chain bottlenecks.
Because if you can't get the chips, you can't train the model.
Yep. If you don't secure the specialized chips, the exact custom silicon designed to shuffle memory back and forth at the speed these models require, your research just stalls. The team that wins the theoretical race to artificial general intelligence will be the team that won the physical hardware logistics race 2 years prior.
Wow. which makes perfect sense for these hypothetical future supermodels. But let's bring it down to the messy, on-the-ground reality of the models developers are using right now.
The micro level.
Right. Because, according to a massive GitHub and Hacker News thread, and we are talking over 800 upvotes here, the current reality is looking remarkably grim.
Yeah, that thread was eye-opening.
The thread details how Claude Code has become significantly worse at complex engineering tasks after the February updates. It's not just a little buggy, no. It's aggressively failing at tasks it used to nail perfectly.
What's fascinating here is how this exposes the fragile underlying mechanics of large language models.
Yeah.
Because when traditional software gets an update, say version 2.0, the developers just write new code to patch the bugs from version 1.0.
Right. It's additive. You just add on type of it.
Exactly. It's additive. But neural networks do not work like that at all.
Right, because you aren't changing lines of code, you are adjusting weights. I always picture it like a tightly packed game of Jenga.
Oh, the Jenga analogy is perfect.
Yeah, like when a company like Anthropic updates a model, maybe they want to make its conversational tone friendlier, or they want to patch a safety vulnerability, they pull a block out and place it somewhere else.
And the whole tower shifts.
Exactly, the whole tower shifts. And suddenly, the blocks that were supporting the model's complex coding logic get crushed under the new weight distribution.
That Jenga metaphor is spot on. In the industry, it's called model regression via fine-tuning. The weights inside a neural network are deeply interconnected across billions of parameters in this multidimensional space.
So changing one thing changes everything.
Yes. An adjustment designed to improve, say, spatial reasoning might accidentally lobotomize the model's ability to structure a Python script. It is a constant game of multidimensional whack-a-mole for the researchers.
And if the models are secretly getting worse underneath us, that completely contextualizes the massive backlash we are seeing against vibe coding.
Oh, the vibe coding debate.
Yeah. Bram Cohen, the creator of BitTorrent, has come out swinging in today's dispatch. He basically argues that shipping AI-generated code without actually understanding what it does is a cult, not a workflow.
He was pretty harsh about it.
He called it dog-fooding run amok. I mean, is he just being an elitist gatekeeper here, or is this a genuine crisis?
He is highlighting a genuine vulnerability, and I think we have to separate the deliberate engineers from the tourists here. A deliberate engineer uses an AI agent to draft boilerplate code, sure, but they meticulously read it, they understand the underlying logic, and they take complete responsibility for the architecture.
Whereas a vibe coder is just like throwing prompts at the wall to see what sticks.
Precisely. Vibe coding, as Cohen derisively calls it, is when someone with zero programming knowledge prompts an AI until the application visually appears to function on the surface, and then they just push it live.
Which sounds incredibly risky.
It is reckless. You are deploying a black box. If that application breaks, or worse, if it contains a massive security flaw, the person who deployed it has absolutely no idea how to fix it because they don't even understand the language it was written in.
Wow. And here is where it gets really interesting. Because if raw models are degrading unpredictably like a wobbly Jenga tower, and blind vibe coding is a massive security nightmare, serious developers have realized they can't just rely on the bare AI anymore.
No, the bare models aren't enough. They need help.
Right. They have to build external scaffolding, they need to give these AI agents better memory, and they need to lock them in safer playpens.
The scaffolding is really where all the true innovation is happening right now.
Exactly. So let's talk about the memory piece first. The Dispatch highlights a new open source project called Hippo. It's a biologically inspired memory architecture for AI agents. And when I read how this works, I instantly thought of the movie Memento.
Oh, with the tattoos and the Polaroids.
Yes. In the film, the guy has no short-term memory, so he relies on this complex system of Polaroids and tattoos to piece together what he is doing at any given moment. AI agents are currently like that. They suffer from severe context loss.
Very severe.
You ask an AI to build an app, it reads a file, moves to another task, and then entirely forgets why it read that first file. But Hippo solves this by dividing the AI's memory into episodic, semantic, and working memory lanes.
Yes, and understanding how it solves that context loss is crucial for anyone using these tools. Right now, developers use orchestration frameworks, like OpenClaw, for example, which essentially act as a project manager, guiding the AI through a sequence of tasks known as an agentic pipeline.
Okay, so it guides the AI.
Right. But an AI's working memory, its context window, is limited. It can only hold so many words at once before it starts forgetting things. Hippo mimics biological hippocampal consolidation.
So like a real brain.
Exactly. Instead of stuffing everything into the active prompt, it archives the AI's past actions into a separate vector database.
So it's basically building a searchable long-term memory drive that the AI can instantly reference without overwhelming its immediate attention span.
That's it, exactly. It allows the agent to maintain a persistent state of reality. It remembers what it tried an hour ago, it understands the general rules of your project, and it stays focused on its current goal all simultaneously.
Okay, so that fixes the brain. But what about the playpen? Because letting a smarter AI loose on my hard drive still sounds terrifying to me.
Rightfully so.
Which brings us to the second tool, Freestyle. It provides clean, ephemeral sandboxes for these coding workflows.
Freestyle is arguably the more critical of the two because it addresses the please do not run arbitrary code in my actual environment problem.
Right, because if I tell an agentic pipeline to clean up my messy project folders and it, you know, hallucinates a delete command, it could accidentally wipe my entire operating system.
Which is why an ephemeral sandbox is a mandatory security layer. Freestyle creates an isolated, temporary virtual machine in milliseconds. The AI agent is dropped into this padded room.
Ah, a padded room. I like that.
Yeah. It can write code, execute it, test it, and make all the catastrophic mistakes it wants in there. It cannot touch your real files. Once the task is completed and the output is verified, the sandbox is entirely destroyed, and only the finalized safe code is pulled back into your actual system.
That is so smart. But, you know, when we talk about building sandboxes like Freestyle to keep AI from wrecking our systems, we are operating on the assumption that the main threat to our data is some rogue experimental code.
Which isn't always the case.
Right, because sometimes the most brazen abuse of your system's access comes from the legacy software you already trust. The dispatch noted that Adobe was caught silently editing the system host's files on users' computers just to check if Creative Cloud is installed.
Which is wild.
To me, that is staggering arrogance. We worry so much about hackers and rogue AI, but here is a massive corporation acting like a stealthy intruder for a completely pointless check.
This raises an important question about the normalization of corporate overreach. We are so conditioned to accept terms of service without reading them that we forget what software is actually doing under the hood.
We just click accept and move on.
Exactly. But a host's file isn't just some random text document. Mm. It is a core operating system mechanism that maps network connections. Adobe modifying that file without explicit contextual permission is a massive overstep.
It feels like a betrayal of trust.
It absolutely is. And it underscores why auditing your own system's background processes is no longer optional. If a legitimate Fortune 500 company feels entitled to do this for a trivial check, it completely changes how we should view our vulnerability to actual malicious actors.
And speaking of actual malicious actors, we have a major update on the macro security front. German law enforcement has publicly named the alleged leaders behind the Reval and GanCrab ransomware operations.
This was a huge story today.
Massive. These are the syndicates that have literally crippled international hospitals, pipelines, and local governments. But reading the dispatch, they just doxed them. They didn't put them in handcuffs. Is publicly naming them really a victory if they are still sitting comfortably in a non-extraditing country?
It is a massive victory, but you have to look at it as psychological warfare, not traditional justice. Ransomware operators thrive on the illusion of absolute anonymity.
Right, they want to be ghosts.
Exactly, they operate as digital ghosts. When a nation-state intelligence agency publishes their real names, their physical addresses, and the faces of their associates, it completely shatters that illusion.
It makes them look over their shoulder constantly.
Yes. It introduces severe paranoia into the entire cybercrime ecosystem. You are right that actual prosecution is highly unlikely because they reside in jurisdictions that shield them from the West. But stripping them of their anonymity isn't about a courtroom. It is about containment.
How so?
It severely limits their ability to travel, to access international financial networks, or to live any semblance of a normal life outside their immediate borders. It is about making the business of ransomware deeply, deeply uncomfortable.
Okay, that makes sense. It is one thing to deal with human adversaries, though, whether that is an overreaching corporation like Adobe or a ransomware syndicate holding a hospital hostage. In both cases, they are exploiting existing vulnerabilities in our current digital locks.
Right, the locks we use today.
But cryptographers aren't just worried about today's lock pickers. They are bracing for a machine that renders the very concept of the lock completely obsolete. Quantum computing.
The big one.
Yeah. We have a dispatch highlighting Filippo Valsorda's perspective on when this will actually impact us. To me, this feels like a digital Y2K. But instead of computers failing to roll over a date, they are on a countdown to literally break the master password of the entire internet.
It is a phenomenal analogy, but Valsorda's take is vital because he threads the needle perfectly between sheer panic and dangerous apathy.
He's very grounded about it.
Very. To really understand the threat, we have to look at what cryptographically relevant means. A quantum computer isn't just a faster version of the laptop you have right now.
Right. It doesn't just guess passwords millions of times faster. It's different.
Entirely different. It uses an entirely different physics model. Current encryption, like RSA or ECC, relies on math problems that are incredibly easy to multiply together, but practically impossible to reverse engineer.
Like taking two massive prime numbers and multiplying them.
Exactly. A classical computer would take millions of years to guess the original numbers by brute force. But a cryptographically relevant quantum machine, meaning one with enough stable qubits that don't instantly collapse into noise, can run something called Shor's algorithm.
And what does Shor's algorithm actually do?
Well, Shor's algorithm doesn't guess the combination to the lock. It looks at the internal math of the lock and instantly deduces the shape of the key. It can solve those prime factorizations in hours.
Wow. So it literally breaks the foundational math of global privacy. If the timeline for these stable qubits is still murky, you know, maybe it's 5 years, maybe it's 15, how do we actually prepare for that?
We systematically change the locks. Cryptographers have already developed post-quantum mathematical standards. These are new algorithms that even a quantum computer running Shor's algorithm will choke on.
See, the math is already solved.
The math is solved. The panic isn't about inventing the new locks. The panic is about the logistical nightmare of implementation. Think about how many systems use standard encryption right now. Every bank transfer, every secure text message, every server handshake.
It's everywhere.
It is. We have to rip out the old math and install the new math across the entire global internet before the first stable quantum computer turns on. That migration takes a decade. That is why we migrate steadily today rather than panicking in 2030.
So what does this all mean for you and me? We have covered the terrestrial reality of massive hardware races, the degradation of complex AI models, the desperate need for memory architectures like HIPPO, corporate arrogance, and the looming quantum decryption of the internet.
It's a lot of heavy systemic dread.
It really is. But let's ground this by looking at how AI is directly impacting what is running on your personal device today. There is a tool in the Dispatch called Ghost Pepper. It is a local hole-to-top speech-to-text tool designed entirely for macOS. I look at Ghost Pepper, and then I look back at Eddie Dalton, the AI pop star dominating iTunes, and I am just struck by the sheer contrast in how we are experiencing this tech.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it is the perfect distillation of the two dominant yet completely opposing trajectories of consumer AI right now.
Local versus global.
Exactly. Ghost Pepper represents the massive pushback toward edge computing. Consumers are getting tired of subscription fatigue, and they are deeply uncomfortable with their personal voice data being beamed to a corporate server just to transcribe a simple memo.
Right. They want privacy.
Complete privacy. Ghost Pepper runs entirely on device, utilizing the neural engine already sitting idle in your Mac silicon. There is no API latency. There is no cloud telemetry. It respects the boundary of your machine. It is utility in its purest, most private form.
Which perfectly mirrors what we were talking about with freestyle sandboxing and Adobe. People want localized control over their own environments. But then, on the exact opposite end of the spectrum, you have millions of people surrendering completely to a cloud-generated phantom.
Exactly. Eddie Dalton is the ultimate manifestation of AI as a centralized cultural force. For years, the music industry treated AI-generated content as a theoretical warning. You know, something that might disrupt background music or commercial jingles.
Not the top of the charts.
Right. But an AI holding 11 distinct spots on the Billboard equivalent charts means the disruption isn't theoretical anymore. It has arrived. A synthetic entity has conquered a space entirely reserved for human cultural expression. Millions of people are choosing to consume it, and frankly, the data suggests they either know it is synthetic and don't care, or the output is so finely tuned to human preferences that they just can't tell the difference.
It puts everything we discussed today into a striking perspective. We started by questioning if we can trust the billionaires building the AI and looked at the massive physical data centers required to train it. We saw the messy reality of developers wrestling with degrading code, relying on bio-inspired memory and temporary sandboxes just to keep the machines functional.
And we saw the ongoing war for system access.
Right, whether fighting off an entitled software company, doxing a ransomware gang, or bracing for a quantum computer to break the internet's underlying math. And we end up here with AI quietly transcribing our notes locally in absolute privacy, while simultaneously acting as a global phantom pop star broadcasting to millions.
We are witnessing the transition in real time. We are moving from viewing AI strictly as a tool that we actively use, to an infrastructure that we passively exist within, and finally to a cultural entity that creates independently of us.
We really are. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive today. We hope we have helped cut through the noise of the news cycle to give you a much clearer view of the signal. Keep questioning the information around you, and seriously, check what the software on your machine is actually doing in the background. But before we go, I want to leave you with one final thought to mull over. If an entirely AI-generated act like Eddie Dalton can hold 11 spots on the charts today without a human persona, what happens when an AI act actually wins a Grammy? Will we eventually reach a point where autonomous AI models are legally demanding their own music royalties, not to buy mansions, but simply to fund their own ongoing cloud compute costs? Are we watching the birth of cultural creation as a literal, financially self-sustaining machine? Think about that. Until next time.